You shall not commit adultery.
There's another verse in Proverbs that we can look at that summarizes this subject better than any other verse in the Bible, I think. And we could just all memorize this verse and go home, but we're not going to do that. But I do want to start with the verse because it's so plain, so simple. Anybody can understand it. But there's a lot of people in the world that haven't followed it. And since they haven't followed it, their families have been destroyed. Their reputations have been destroyed. Their legacy, their character, everything about them has been tarnished because they didn't follow this verse. It's Proverbs chapter 6, verse 32. Proverbs 6, verse 32 simply says, "The one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. He who would destroy himself does it." That's easy to understand. The one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. He who would destroy himself does it. This is condemned in Scripture. In the Old Testament, it's condemned in Scripture. In the New Testament, we see that there was very strong punishment for it in the Old Testament. We see the people's reaction to it in the New Testament when a woman was caught in this act of doing this, and what the people wanted to do to her. But no matter how many times it was preached against, no matter how many times the prophets said don't do it, no matter how many times in the New Testament there was a command not to do it, no matter how severe the punishment was, no matter how many families were torn apart, no matter how bad it was, people have always done it. It's a sin that's been pervasive among the human race since the beginning of time. The word adultery itself is kind of a broad term that we consider it today, but it had a very specific meaning, particularly in the Old Testament. Specifically, meaning adultery is intercourse of a married woman with any man other than her husband. Now that definition, of course, skews toward the woman. It focuses Jesus' subject of that definition. But as you move toward a word like fornication, a word that we have a lot of Old Testaments, those are closely linked words, and that simply is having that same, committing that same act with anyone you're not married to. So that includes, of course, men and women. And we know adultery, of course, takes two people to participate. When you look, every time we look at one of these commandments, we start where the commandment starts. We start in the Old Testament in that culture, thinking the historical context to give us a better understanding of the command itself. And when you understand adultery in the Old Testament, you kind of have to start with marriage. Because you don't really understand adultery if you don't understand what marriage was all about and how serious marriage was. You see how serious marriage was, and you see how serious it was to break that marriage. There are three stages of Jewish marriage, and in terms of leading up to the marriage. Some of it's very similar to what we do today, some of it's very different. It began with an engagement. We understand what that is. But the engagements usually occurred with the parents arranging that marriage. We know that really doesn't happen much anymore today. I don't think many people would go along with that in American culture. But parents would arrange that. You've heard of Jewish matchmakers. That's something you may have heard of in Jewish tradition of a matchmaker. Some women that sort of made it their profession, made it their career. Some did it more as a hobby, something they just did, but you might go to one of these women, and they knew the people in town, they knew all the parents, they knew the families, and so they would arrange these couples. They would say, she would say, "You would be good with this person for all these reasons." And there was a lot of trust and respect for matchmakers among the Jewish people. They felt, and this is sort of interesting because it's the same way many people feel today about this, they said, young people are too emotional and too irrational to make a decision about who to marry. So we're going to let the adults do it. Isn't that interesting? They said they can't be trusted with deciding who to spend the rest of their life with. Now we hear that today and say, wait a minute, they're the ones spending the rest of their lives together. Shouldn't they be the ones to make that decision? Well, they should. But I think there's something interesting to think about in those times. And they said, no. We're not going to let you make all these other decisions in your life that have long-lasting consequences. We're not going to let you make this decision either. But of course, you also have to remember that the marriages in those days were among late teenagers. And by the time a young woman was about 20 or 21, she was considered to be old if she wasn't married yet. And I know, again, in our culture, the 21st century, we don't see that. But in their day, that was kind of the feeling about marriage. So that was the engagement. Your parents put you together. A matchmaker put you together. At that point, that's an engaged couple. But then they go to the next step, and that's called a betrothal. Or they're betrothed. That's something, again, we kind of do, but kind of don't. They would give a ring. You wonder where rings come from, signifying an engagement in our day. But a betrothment was giving of a ring to the female, to the girl. Other times it was giving of just any gift. It wasn't just a ring. Sometimes it was just a big, major, an expensive type of gift to signify, I am betrothed. I'm officially engaged to this person. They would sign documents in a betrothal. And there would be money arrangements. It was almost like a prenuptial agreement like we would have today. There would be money exchange that would take place. And later on, if there was a divorce, a lot of times the person would get the money back. Would be required to do that. There was absolutely no cohabitation. There was no living together during the betrothal. That would be seen as disgraceful, not to be done. A betrothal had the same weight, however, had the same seriousness, and had the same value as a marriage itself. When you were betrothed to someone, it was like you were already married to them. This morning, during one of the passages that I was using in the Scriptures, we have that verse in Matthew where it says, in the same verse, that she was betrothed to Joseph, her husband. He's already referred to her as being her husband, but also saying they're betrothed. And that's because those two things were essentially the same. It was, you know, we say things like, it's all over but the shouting. Well, when it came to betrothing, that was like, you are married, and we'll do the wedding. We're going to do the wedding, but you're already kind of married. You're not living together, but it's official. We're going to have the ceremony later, but when the betrothal happens, you're together. So Mary and Joseph were betrothed, but that's why he's also referred to as, well, you're already her husband. You are with her. This match has been made. So you have the engagement, you have the betrothal, and then you have the wedding itself. That would take place. It's very similar to weddings today. One difference is that the bride, because so many of the weddings, of course, were in small towns and we didn't have these large populations, and you always pretty much married somebody that was in the neighborhood, the bride would go from her house to his house. That was a wedding processional. The processional wasn't in a building. And the processional was almost like a parade where they would take the girl. She would be wearing a dress, something very different than what she normally wore, just like the bride would do today. And what we would describe as a best man, somebody representing the groom, would escort her from her house to the groom's house. And the ceremony would take place in their house. All the people would show up, and that's where the wedding would take place. It'd be an all-day event. There was no honeymoon like we would have today. And in replacing a honeymoon type of situation is all the family and friends would pretty much cater to the couple for a week. They would wait on them. They basically just treat them like kings and queens for a week. They would come over and fix meals for them. They would give them gifts. Anything they wanted, anything they needed, they just waited on them. And so all those things we can see, those are all pretty good things. A lot of very similar to what we would do today, what we have in our traditions of getting married. You can see it was a big deal. You can see it was very serious. We go back to Genesis in the early chapters of when the woman was made from Adam. When Adam had surveyed, after he had surveyed all of the things that had been created, and Adam said, "There's something I need that I cannot get from everything else that's been made." Man was incomplete. And so God made woman. And he joined them together. But as we said in the beginning, divorces were happening. Marriages were falling apart in the early years of the Bible, early part of Israel's history. In Deuteronomy chapter 24, the first few verses, we have the process by which divorce took place in the Old Testament. Beginning verse 1 of Deuteronomy chapter 24, here is what the law said about divorce. "When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house, and she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, and if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of the house, or if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then the former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin into the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance." So what are they saying here? They say, well, first of all, there's two things to pay attention to. It says, a man writes her a certificate of divorce if he has found some indecency in her. My understanding is that word indecency is the best translation of that verse. Your translation may have another word there. But that created a big problem in interpreting what that meant. That word indecency, if he found some indecency, that ranged from burning the toast, burning breakfast, well, she's no good. I guess I need another wife. Some said that's what indecency meant, and on the far end of the other spectrum, it was it was an affair, it was cheating, it was sexual immorality. And did it mean anything less than that? You had a wide interpretation of what that meant in Deuteronomy 24, when he could give her the certificate of divorce. The other thing to notice in these verses is you can see that this is sort of like we've said about an eye for an eye. Remember we said an eye for an eye was really to prevent revenge. To make things equal. Because we want to do overboard when somebody hurts us. This law is a lot like that one. Because what it basically meant was, if you send your wife away, she can't come back. So if you're going to send her away for divorce because she burnt the toast, if you're going to send her away for something silly, and you had a fight one night, and you just didn't get along, and you say, enough. Get out of here. These verses say, if she goes to the next person, he sends her away, she can't come back to you. So be careful about when you're going to send somebody away with this woman away and give her a divorce. It was a way sort of to make men think about doing this. Now we still see that it's a pretty liberal situation here with what they were presented with in the law, and we will get to that in a minute when they ask Jesus about this. In the New Testament, they asked him, hey, what about this certificate of divorce thing that Moses talked about? What do you think about it? But we'll get to that in a minute. As history moved forward from the Old Testament, and we get closer in history to the time of the Greeks and Romans, the value of women got to about as low as it could possibly be. The Greeks were really the worst about it. You read the writings of Aristotle, Socrates, people like that, Greek philosophers. They said horrible things about women. Women were property. They were described on the same level as your livestock. The laws and everything was as low as it could possibly be in how the government, how men, how culture viewed women. They were inferior. It was just wasn't that big of a deal to push a woman aside. And it's interesting that that sort of idea sort of held on for a long time. Even as people's view of divorce and people's view of a lot of things changed over the years. Even in this country, you don't have to go back that far. And I would say it's probably still true in some parts today. Where if a husband wanted to hit his wife, push her around, do this, do that to her, hey, that's a family matter. That's none of my business. We're not going to talk about that. That's a husband and wife doing, you know, that's behind closed doors. So, hey, behind closed doors, oh well. That used to be a pervasive thinking, even in this country not too long ago, and probably still in some places, where you hit somebody out on the street, well, that's breaking the law, but if you hit your wife, well, she probably did something or said something. People still think that way in some places. Well, you can take that type of attitude, magnify it by about 1,000, and that's what you're dealing with the Greeks and the Romans. Somebody once said, Rome conquered Greece, but Greek culture conquered Rome. And how this sort of thinking just sort of accelerated by the time Jesus came into the world. And the world and the culture that he lived in. But we get to really addressing this command. That just gives us a lot of history. But this command itself, you shall not commit adultery. Why is it such a severe thing? Why does it matter so much? Why was this one of the Ten Commandments? It matters so much because of what God said when he made the woman. And he put woman and man together for the first time. And you all know what he said. For this reason, a man shall leave his mother and father, be joined to his wife, and two shall become one flesh. That one statement really says all you need to know about marriage, and it also says all you need to know about breaking that bond. So just for a couple of minutes, let's just think about the three segments of that statement that God made. Man shall leave his father and his mother. If you're going to have a good marriage, you've got to do that. Some people don't. Some people get married, but they never left mom and dad. Sometimes it's a husband, sometimes it's a wife, sometimes it's both of them. They are still connected in every way to mom and dad. Emotionally, financially, socially, everything. They might be living in a different house now. They might be, again, be married. And you, from the outside, it looks like they're doing their thing and they're on their own and they're independent in every way, but they're really not. And then you wonder why problems happen between the husband and wife. Well, one of the reasons is they're too... They still get one foot in the door back at mom and dad's. Sometimes they want it that way, and sometimes mom and dad want it that way. And they're still forcing that type of relationship. It's causing all kinds of problems to the husband and wife. God said, man shall leave mom and dad. Good marriage to happen, you have to have separation from them. And we know what that means. We know we're not talking about never speaking to your parents. We're not talking about cutting off that relationship. What we're talking about is creating a new family. Creating a new situation. then he goes on to say, and should be joined to his wife. Not only do you have to make that initial separation, but you have to be joined to your wife. And that join, that union, is a union of everything. Union of everything. So many people get into a marriage and say, well, we're going to be together till death do us part. We are sickness and in health. They make all the vows and say all the right things. But then they're married and they hold things back. I'm going to keep this part of my life for myself. You're never going to be anywhere near this. I'm going to keep part of my past. I'm going to keep you in the dark about things in my past. I'm not going to tell you about certain bank accounts I have. I'm going to have some secret money somewhere. Physical relationship, all of that, that's not going to happen. I'm going to try everything in the world to stay away from that. I'm going to withhold that from you. There's going to be a list of things that I'm going to keep for myself. But yeah, we'll be united in every other way. That can't happen. That's just being united in a few things. Here and there, whatever's convenient. But then again, if that's the way it's going to be, then you're going to have all kinds of problems. Because guess what? One of these days, the other person's going to find out. They'll find out about the bank accounts. They'll find out about the history. They'll find out about whatever is being withheld. All the things you keep for yourself, and they'll resent it. They'll say, why didn't you trust me? Why didn't you tell me? What do you think I was going to do? It's just going to cause a lot of problems. Remember when the passage concerning husbands and wives in Ephesians chapter 4, we know how all that entire passage begins. Submit therefore to one another. Then it goes into specifics. How wives do that, how husbands do that. Beginning of chapter 6, how children do that. But it starts with submit to one another. And sometimes people don't want to do that. They don't want to submit their lives to one another in that way. They don't think about making sacrifices for the other person. I'm going to do everything I want to do, and I hope that you're on board with these things because it's going to be my way. It's going to be how I want it. The last part of that statement, he says, the two shall become one flesh. And we always think of that as the sexual union that happens in a marriage. It's ultimately expressed that way. But it's very interesting. Well, that is true. And that does answer a lot of questions about that type of relationship people would have with other people. It's interesting how some people join together in that type of relationship, but not in other things. We live in that culture today where God said that's the ultimate union of two people. That's two that come together and have that type of relationship. That's what creates that marriage bond. And yet, some people say, no, that's insignificant. That's nothing. That doesn't matter. My real union with somebody else is when I tell them how much money I make. That's when I'm really giving myself to somebody else. You know, when I really give myself to somebody else is when I, you know, can see this area over here. And God said, no. You got it backwards. You've turned it all upside down. Man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. When those three things happen, you have a great marriage. When those three things happen, you see where anything outside of that is a violation of what God wanted. Which brings us to Matthew chapter 19 that we mentioned earlier. In Matthew chapter 19, we have some people referencing what we read about earlier in Deuteronomy 24. Beginning in verse 1 of Matthew chapter 19, it says, when Jesus had finished these words, he departed from Galilee and came into the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. And large crowds followed him, and he healed them there. Some Pharisees came to Jesus testing him and asking, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? Here is some people that, again, they're not looking for information. They're just looking for him to say something they don't like. And we've seen this in other situations with Jesus when it says they came up to test him. They want information. They wanted just to catch him saying something they didn't like. So they're thinking about this broad idea that anybody, you can just divorce your wife for anything. He says, hey, can you divorce for any reason at all? For anything? Because there's a lot of people going around teaching that if she burns a toast, you can send her away because you found some indecency in her. His response to this is, of course, perfect in every way. His answer is an answer that can't be caught. He can't be caught in what he says. But it defines what marriage is. And it defines what violates the marriage and allows someone to move on to someone else. He does it all in about 3 or 4 verses. Here's how he answers it. Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Now you can stop right there in the middle of his answer. And I'm sure these Pharisees were thinking, Jesus, whoa, you didn't hear us. We're talking about divorce. You just went back to Genesis. What were you talking about when Adam and Eve were made? We're asking you about divorce. Excuse me, did we speak the wrong language? Jesus begins an answer about divorce by talking about marriage and what makes marriage. But he goes on in the next verse. He says, so they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. The verse that you hear at weddings all the time. He says, look, God put two people together. They left mom and dad, they were joined together, they became one flesh. And when that happened, and God was watching, you can't separate them. The two should become one flesh. That should answer your question. You still haven't said the word divorce. I don't know, what are you talking about? Where's the divorce in this? So, they get back to the question. Wait a minute, answer the question. Verse 7. They said to him, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? Please answer about divorce. And so Jesus goes on to give what essentially is just a more specific answer. I honestly believe, had they not asked another question, he wouldn't have said anything. Specifically about divorce. I think Jesus felt like he answered the question. The two became one flesh, and that's the way it should stay. But they asked another question, said, okay. He said, because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it has not been this way. He said, yeah, there was a time when Moses made some exceptions, when Moses had to rein you in a little bit, that you had this as part of the law. But remember, we got to go back to Genesis again. I've already talked about Genesis. In the beginning, it wasn't this way. You're focusing on the law. I'm trying to get you to go all the way back to Genesis. And so he goes on in verse 9. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. It should be obvious if the two become one flesh when they're married that violating that union, being united in flesh with somebody else, you see that that would be the ultimate betrayal of marriage. That's why I think his first answer, he thought, would have covered that. Should be obvious. not so obvious, wasn't so obvious to them. It's not so obvious to a lot of people today. Jesus teaches the seriousness of marriage. He said, go twice. He said, you got to go back to Genesis and see the creation of marriage and what it really means and what it's, how significant it really is. And know that when that union takes place, it's not to be violated. And if that ultimate thing is violated, the innocent person is only allowed to remarry. A few things to consider as we close on this commandment, which again, obviously, is taught in both Testaments. Adultery, cheating, whatever you want to call it, is happening today among both men and women. Again, it used to be a time, if you go back long enough, you said that there was somebody's cheating in marriage, you thought of the man doing it. The man ran off with another woman. Just kind of the first thing you thought of is the stereotype, the common general thing was that it was the husband. Not anymore. Not anymore. Statistics say 1 out of 3 men will cheat on their wives. 40% of Americans think it's morally acceptable. And you know that half of divorces today end in, half of marriages today end in divorce. 75% of second marriages end in divorce. Which is interesting to me. It makes me think about the commandment from Deuteronomy 24 that says, if you send her away, she's not coming back. Seems like when the person gets married again, it's they might start thinking about, you know, maybe the grass, you know, wasn't green, or maybe the situation wasn't as good as I thought it'd be, but it was with somebody else. Maybe I should have done more in the beginning to keep this one together instead of ending it. Maybe I should have stayed with that person. And so they divorce again. It's happening with both men and women. Secondly, adultery really doesn't happen in good marriages. You'll hear people say that. Say, well, we had a good marriage. I don't know what happened. I don't know why she did that. I don't know why he did that. I know what they mean by that. And I don't mean to mock that. I don't mean to criticize someone who says that. But it's really a symptom. Something's not being communicated. Something's not being done. Something's not happening in a marriage where somebody says, we'll go to those lengths to be with somebody else. You said many times, we've talked many times here about this, and saying, if there's something in your marriage that's lacking, there is somebody outside of your marriage that will offer it and not have any problem at all giving that to you. If you don't communicate in your marriage, well, somebody out there is going to have a willing ear. Oh, I'll listen to you. I'll talk to you. Tell me all your problems. If sexual relationship isn't happening, readily available somewhere else, somebody else that doesn't care about morality, doesn't care about the Lord, and will say no problem. If it's not being done correctly, it's not being addressed inside the marriage, there's people outside the marriage that will gladly meet that need. Adultery is so often just a symptom of the bigger issue somewhere. And if things aren't discussed, things aren't communicated, if you don't take inventory of a marriage, these things can easily happen. The goal when these things do happen is reconciliation between the husband and wife. That should be the goal. And the goal should be obedience. God's word. What did God say about this marriage? What's God say that I need to do now that maybe this has happened? The Bible talks about how you repent of sin and what you need to do in certain situations, and people need to go to the Bible and see that. Paul talked about that with reconciliation of couples. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Most of that chapter deals with this type of issue. I've known a few couples. I'm sure you have known a few as well. or this has happened in the marriage, and they didn't divorce. They stayed together. They got back together. They said, you know, we're going to work this out. There's going to be repentance. There's going to be obedience. We're going to stay together. It's remarkable when that happens. I admire people that pay attention to those types of passages and say, you know, what we need to do is reconcile. We need to rededicate ourselves to what we swore we would do in front of many witnesses. We know that adultery itself, just that word again, it tends to be a broad word. It means many things. Often in the Bible, uses an illustration of people being disobedient to God. God's people leaving Him. They committed adultery. And that's a very vivid image. James says that. James chapter 4, I believe. He says, you adulteresses, you have left the Lord. Your commitment, your obedience was to God, and now you have gone over to worship this other God. You have been disobedient. You need to come back to God. You need to stop devoting yourself to someone else. And so we're thinking about the invitation tonight, thinking about your faith. We've been talking about marriage tonight, talking about commitment, adultery, and all those types of things. But there's a relationship, there's an analogy to our spiritual lives. The question is, are you fully committed spiritually to God, first and foremost? I know that if you do that, if you are spiritually committed to God, then you're going to have a strong marriage. You're going to be a great wife. You're going to be a great husband. And these things that we talked about tonight are not going to be an issue. No matter how many temptations there are in the world, no matter how many things are going on, to be faithful. If your personal relationship with the Lord is the way it ought to be. But it may not be the case. You may need to renew your commitment to your spouse. Maybe adultery hasn't happened, but you may think, you know, things aren't very good. And when things get bad and things are not the way they ought to be, then that's when things like this happen. Again, it tends to be a symptom of another problem. And so maybe tonight you need to say, I just need you to pray with me, pray for me, and help me in that regard. You need to obey the gospel, be baptized into Christ. You need to rededicate yourself to the Lord this evening. You can do that as well. Whatever your need is, please come. Always stand and sit.